I'm Jacob Wilkins. On this episode of Let's Talk, I sit down with former New York Giants running back Tiki Barber for an exclusive interview.
We talk about fatherhood.
When I retired and left the spotlight, that's when the challenges really, really presented themselves, including going through a divorce. So now that I've, taken big steps back and looked at who I want to be to my kids, it's helped in a lot of ways.
What do you want to be to your kids?
Someone who's always there, supporting them no matter what they want to do.
The dangers of playing football.
For my last year, which was 2006, we played the Cowboys. I got a concussion. I know I did because I was unconscious. Literally four plays later, because Drew Bledsoe threw an interception right before halftime to Sam Madison, and after halftime, Tony Romo started his career. It's been now going on for 7-8 years. I went right back onto the field, and knowing what I know now, there's no way I would have done that or been allowed to do that. But in that moment, I remember saying, I can't keep getting knocked out or knocked around and not have a long-term repercussion.
The chances of mending his relationship with Giants head coach Tom Coughlin.
Yeah, if the relationship happens, it happens. If not, I'm not going to lose sleep over it.
Right.
Tom's a great coach. He didn't treat guys the right way. He changed. And I think to his benefit, and the guys view him differently now. But I'm never going to sit idly and say somebody was the way they were if they weren't.
And what this next chapter holds in store for him.
Every day presents something new. And being a businessman, in addition to walking a separate, parallel life as a sports broadcaster, at the same time starting a family, number two, while raising four kids with an ex-wife, it's a lot, right? So it's hard to even think about what's going to happen next year. But I know one thing. I know the things that I learned as an athlete will always push me towards success, always, because failure is not an option.
Tiki Barber, one-on-one, right now on Let's Talk.
We're about to start episode 7 of our Let's Talk podcast. Jacob Wilkins here, and really a pleasure to be joined by Tiki Barber. Needs no introduction, Tiki. I really appreciate you doing this.
Glad to be. Thank you.
Yeah. Tell me, what is it, 10 months into the show now, TBD? Yeah. I think we finally found some office space for it.
We did find office space. There's a little office back here.
We found an empty office in the Hudson Street corridor with windows.
That was given to us, but was used as storage before, but now is empty. I think we're going to have to go claim this and
put
a couch in here so we have somewhere to call our own.
Right. You don't have to deal with the staffers out there.
we like the staffers.
I know.
We rely on them.
Let's be frank. They're a bunch of, pests.
They're sports fanatics, which we kind of love. No, but the first 10 months have been awesome.
Yeah.
We found our niche. We have a great chemistry together, myself and Dana and Brandon. And I get to talk sports for a living. And some of it has been on the job learning, because honestly, I didn't know a ton about baseball. But luckily, BT played baseball through college at Marist. And it's a sport that he's passionate about. So I've learned along the way the nuances and the ins and outs of talking it. And that's helped me appreciate what I watch. When Major League Baseball is on.
Because you had done the barbershop,
yep.
I guess football focus,
yep.
Obviously you've done Today and done Football Night in America, but that's interesting.
Yeah.
How did this come about, this opportunity to do this show?
It's interesting. Back in 1999, when I was kind of a marginally good NFL player, I started to look around New York for things to do.
Mm-hmm.
There's tons of businessmen here, there's tons of opportunities. And I got hooked up with Mark Chernoff,
mm-hmm.
who was local WFAN here. And he said, hey, if you want to come test it out, come do some of the stuff overnight. So working with Joe Beningo and Erica Herskowitz, who fills in also for the anchor position sometimes, I went over to Queens at 10 o'clock at night and started talking sports. And it was in the off season, so I was talking hockey. Something that I didn't know how to say these guys' names, much less, the rules. What's the blue line? Type of thing. What's offsides? And I started to grow an appreciation for talking the sport as opposed to just playing the sport. You fast forward, how many years later? 14 years later, CBS Sports Network is about to launch, and Chernoff and Eric Spitz are kind of in charge of finding the talent. And I got an opportunity to come read with BT, and it went great. We had an instant chemistry, and we went from there.
And I know you and BT share the same agent. Data comes in, and I guess you guys were just grouped, and, and it works.
Yep. It was kind of one of those things where Mark Lepsupter, who was our collective agent, got presented the opportunity, and it was you know, convenient to just test his two clients together. And it worked. BT was actually on the West Coast, out in San Francisco, doing a gig there. And but he's from Brooklyn, so he wanted to come home. And this opportunity was perfect for both of us. And then we added Dana in the mix because we wanted a third voice and a female voice. And after going through a few different candidates, she was the one who had a presence, a great knowledge of sports, having been at ESPN for so long. She fit right in, and we can't offend her. You know, she's been around the boys for so long, not being in that network up in Bristol, that she fit right in.
And you and BT knew each other well, or
not
casually?
Real well. We had crossed paths at 1050 ESPN, which is local ESPN, when I was doing a show with Wally and the Keek. We should do that over at the 4040 Club, Jay-Z's club over there. So I've run across BT a couple of times. Just in a previous life as a football player. This was the first time that I had an opportunity to work extensively with him on the broadcast side, though.
And ironically, I guess, you can hear on the internet in New York, but you're not in New York directly.
Yeah,
I guess that's
it's the oxymoron that I always talk about. We're a national show, but we're not in New York, the biggest media market in the world, in some people's estimation. But we'll get here eventually. We're growing our affiliates across the country, and it makes it unique because we get callers from California. A lot of them are truck drivers who are on the road at 3 in the morning, West Coast time. We get them from the South. We get them from Texas. We get them from everywhere, which makes our show dynamic because a lot of national shows don't take callers. They just broadcast out and disseminate information. We actually enjoy the feedback from different parts of this country.
Is this something you want to do for the long haul?
Oh yeah, it definitely is. I mean, I've flirted around with so many different things post career, even during my career, doing TV and radio and starting businesses, and I love sport. Everything to me comes back to sports, and I'm excited that this opportunity was presented, and I've started to really embrace the venue and the medium to talk, right? It's one thing to talk in a soundbite, which is what you do on television. It's another to explain your opinion on different things and learn new things as sports evolve.
And I know you were doing something on breast cancer awareness today, but do you feel you get the chance to visit at the Today Show? You were doing very dynamic stories.
Yeah, of course.
I mean, same-sex parents and all sorts of culturally stimulating topics. Do you feel you get to venture into that territory?
Yeah, we get to touch it a little bit. You know, not as extensively as doing a four-camera shoot around, an African immigrant down in Clarkston, Georgia. But we can touch on whatever we want. You know, we've become more of a morning show as opposed to a sports-only driven show. We can touch on those things. And we had Charles Tillman on this morning. And the NFL celebrates Breast Cancer Awareness Week every month, every October. We get to talk about that. My mom's a 17-year survivor, and we love those type of initiatives that mean something outside of just what we're doing on the playing field.
And I want to get to your mom, but take me through the rest of your day, which starts early, and credit to you for getting up, and you are here.
Yeah.
This isn't like a 5:30, you're here at 4 in the morning.
This isn't a show up right before the show starts type of endeavor, because there's so much going on. Mm-hmm. I mean, sports lives in prime time. In America, and so that means usually 7 or 8 o'clock start, and then sometimes ending after midnight. And so you can't watch it all. You try to watch as much as you can so you can give an actual perspective, but the bulk of it happens in the morning, where you catch up. You figure out what did I miss, what do I need to know, what point do I want to make about this game, whether it be NBA, NFL, whatever we're talking about, Major League Baseball. And so that happens in the morning. So I'm out of bed at about 3:50. I'm in the car shortly after, and I get here at about 4:30 or so, and get an hour and a half to prepare, and then we go on the show. And then I started a company about 2 years ago. We've been live as an e-commerce website for about a year, booking talent, mostly athletes, around different types of experiences, lunches or dinners or flag football games or corporate engagements, things that you would normally think athletes would do. But we put it in an e-commerce environment. So when I leave here in the morning, whether it be 9:30 or 10 o'clock, I go to my office up on in Midtown, 29th and 6th, 29th and 5th, and help run that company and grow. It's fun being in the e-commerce world. It's a lot of challenges, but we know we're providing a service and have aggregated a market that needed a marketplace. We created the marketplace.
Thuzio.
Thuzio is the name of that business, yeah.
Yes. And tell me, from a business standpoint, I guess you are, you'll just use an example. Let's say you're listed for $2,000
yep.
for like flag football,
yep.
to play flag football with Tiki,
yep.
which I'm
yeah.
working on my throws.
Yeah, well,
but so is the business model, you guys are charging, you're making money off the.
So we're charging as any other intermediary would charge. If you went to an agent, who in some cases we view as a monopolist because he controls supply, we're taking that supply and making it readily available to the masses, whether that be individuals or corporations. For that, we charge 20%, and that's what a standard agent fee is.
To the athlete to be posted or to the person that's...
Well, it's kind of both. So we ask our talent what they want to make, and then we charge the client 20% more. So if I wanted to walk away with $1,000 on an event, we charge the client $1,250. And so it makes a win-win for everybody. But because we have price transparency, because we have masses of talent, we're up to 1,400 now talent on our site. There's downward pressure on pricing, so it's attainable. So it's not something you look at and say, "There's no way that I can do that." Right? It's I can't spend $10,000 to have XYZ John Starks come to my party. But because we can put it in a marketplace where it's replicable and he can get booked more than once, he's willing to do it for a lesser price. It's supply and demand that hasn't really touched this athlete or high-touch personality market ever. And do it where you can pay with a credit card and have ease of booking is something that is innovative and we're excited about.
Is there ever friction with the talent and their agents?
No, interestingly, agents initially see us as a threat, but what we actually are is a complement to what they're already doing. It's not in their business model to chase these smaller deals, whether it be $500, $200 for a coaching session, or $1,000 for a lunch. That's a lot of legwork for them to book that event. For us, it's easy because it's in an e-commerce environment. And so it gives them freedom to go chase these big fat tail deals, these Cadillac endorsements, et cetera, while they can still get their clients served doing things that are local to them and easy to book. So we're actually a great complement. We have a lot of agency relationships who have onboarded their talent because they know that we provide a service to them.
And here's the interesting thing. It doesn't surprise me at all that you'd be in a successful business venture.
Yeah.
But when I think of your goals to be outside of the box as an athlete after your career, when I think of athletes being paid, $1,000 for dinner or whatever, to me that's, fairly typical. That's what you'd expect to have an athlete. So, I don't know, maybe I see the irony in you setting up these opportunities that I didn't think you'd ever want to be in.
Well, it's all about serendipity. When I was about 2 years ago, not really doing anything, I got hooked up with Mark Gerson, who is an entrepreneur, a serial entrepreneur in New York City, because I went to school with his brother at UVA, and he said, just go have lunch. And so we started talking, and I was able to take a passion of mine, which is sports and sports stars interacting with the public, and meld it with his ability to start and run businesses. And so we created this e-commerce marketplace, and it's burgeoning. We don't have a clue of how big it can actually get, but it brings me back to what I studied in college. I was an MIS major at UVA, so database design and programming is what I knew. So bringing sports and technology and entrepreneurship in New York City is a great combination if you find all the right pieces, and we did.
Is it weird though? One thing, if you're speaking, being paid a speaking engagement, you're speaking to a large group.
Yep.
To be at a lunch and you're being paid $1,000.
Yep.
Do you feel objectified?
No,
I don't know.
Not really, because what we're tapping into is people's passions. and they really want a chance to meet you. Heretofore, you couldn't do it. Even if you wanted to you know, meet Rondé and play golf with him, if you didn't know him or know his age, there was no way that you could do it. Now there's a way to do it. So that odd, you know, what would seem a forced relationship actually happens really seamlessly and without friction or, you know, awkwardness. And, you know, it's just a way that we've learned to consume celebrity. I mean, think about what we watch on television these days. It's sports and reality television. We want to interact. And how do we interact right now? It's through Twitter and Facebook and other social media outlets. We've created a way for those type of interactions to happen in person. And so we're onto something. We just got to now perfect it.
And I suppose the businessman, I don't know what feedback you've gotten, views it as an investment because you could have a you and Mark Gerson situation.
Absolutely.
Simply over a lunch.
Absolutely. So you never know when you're going to go to lunch with somebody and that's going to have a long-term economic professional benefit just because you had lunch. Also, you know, corporations, they do this consistently. They're all about entertaining or brand development,
right?
Or, you know, how do I internally motivate my employees? So they're always looking to do these types of events. And before, it's a pain point to have to negotiate with someone to get someone to show up. We've made it so easy for them to curate an event and make it happen. And so corporations have become our biggest clients because they have the budgets already to do this. It's not like they have to think about spending the T&L budget to bring in talent. They're doing it already. We've just made it easier for them.
Congratulations to you and your wife on...
Thank you.
Baby number one for her,
yes.
Baby
number five.
That's a lot of kids.
It is a lot of kids, but I love kids.
Yeah.
And my boys are getting old now. They're 12, almost 12, so 11 and 9. And then my twin girls are 3. And, you know, Tracy and I figured if we're going to have kids, let's have them when they're young.
Yeah.
My other ones are still young. And it's, you know, it's a new transition, but it's... I love it. You know, I'm loving the fact that our baby Brooklyn, which we named her already, is going to come into this world around Christmas and give us the greatest present that we could ever imagine.
I was reading that you mentioned your mother,
yeah.
And I couldn't believe what I read. I know she's a straight shooter.
Oh,
but
yeah,
that,
big time.
That USA Today piece when she said you had to grow as a father.
Yeah, of course.
How did you react, though?
Well, it's hard to be a father and be an athlete. You get caught in the cycle of performing and being somebody to everybody. You know what I mean? Because everybody's looking at you, and you're on a stage, and you're lauded, but you're criticized, and that it possesses your life sometimes. And it's hard to be a father in that environment because you're always in the spotlight. But when I retired and left the spotlight, that's when the challenges really, really presented themselves, including going through a divorce. So now that I've, you know, taken big steps back and looked at who I want to be to my kids, it's helped in a lot of ways.
What do you want to be to your kids?
Someone who's always there, supporting them no matter what they want to do. Right now, my boys want to play sports. They want to be football players or baseball players or whatever it may be. And so I give them all the tactical and emotional and you know, whatever support they need, but at some point that may not happen, right? I don't want them to feel like they have to be athletes simply because I was an athlete. And being a father figure, you know, someone who can be an example for, you know, how to do things the right way.
How have you grown as a father?
I think it's about awareness. You know, just like in the lessons you learn in sports are very similar in life. It's about awareness of how to be successful at it, and realizing that you're not perfect, and you have to figure out how to make yourself available when need be. And so I think that's the biggest thing. And you know, my kids are awesome. They completely adore where we are in life, despite some of the challenges that we've had.
What have you become more aware of?
I think the biggest thing is you know, things that you say, like how you say things, and just the fact that you do say things, because kids need to hear it. Sometimes we assume that they're just going to figure it out on their own. They're not. They need to hear it.
And you wrote all those kids' books.
Yeah, we've written a bunch of kids' books.
You and Rondé.
We have my twin brother Rondé and I have written 9 now. We have a contract for 3 more. They've hit a niche. Boys don't particularly like to read at 11, 12, 13 years old. So we've written a sports themed books that tell lessons about challenges you're gonna face going to middle school, going to high school, balancing sports and academics, and personal issues that may come up, and putting in around sports themes, memes has been something that's been fun and fulfilling. You don't write children's books to make money. You do it because you have a message you want to disseminate, and we've had a great vehicle to do it with Simon & Schuster in our series of books.
How have you learned from Rondé as a dad?
Rondé's interesting because he's singularly focused on whatever it is he's doing. That's why he played football. Never got involved in any other things that I started to get involved with, media, business, etc. And I think as a father, he's intense, and that's why he was such a good player. He's extraordinarily intense, and he's kind of nurtured his daughters, especially his youngest daughter, into being that way as an athlete. She's playing golf, and she just won a golf tournament. And I'm sure a lot of it is because of how Rondé focuses her on success, which is why he had such a great level of success as a player.
And it's funny, the perception, I always thought of him as the laid-back Florida guy.
Well, he seems like that, but
right.
But he's not. He's as intense as they come. And the little details of football and life, he cares about. And down to his diet, and it's one of the things that differentiates us. Him going to Florida where there's not as many distractions, and me being in New York where there's a lot of distractions. I'm fortunate to have someone really close to learn from.
Does he like being an analyst for Fox News?
He does. I don't think he was ready for the challenge of traveling as consistently and frequently as he has to now. But he enjoys it because he loves the sport. He loves the X's and O's, and that's what allowed him to play so long. It wasn't because he was a great athlete at 37 years old. It's because he could do it from the neck up.
Would you ever want to do games?
I don't think so.
No.
I think I like taking it all in, and then talking about it as opposed to doing it in real time. I mean, I probably could, but I think there's something else. There's something more deep about seeing everything as opposed to focusing on one.
Gotcha. Obviously, much used stories well documented, but I sort of lost track when the football comeback didn't work out.
Yeah.
That was your purpose to get off the mat, so to say.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was something you were comfortable with.
Of course.
And when that doesn't work out, what are you thinking?
Well, it's life goes forward. You don't worry about setbacks or perceptions because you're not going to please all the people all the time. And so why even try? It's more about what you can internally do to motivate yourself to make that next step. So people are going to help you up and pull you off and push you forward and give you shoulders to stand on. But ultimately, you need to do something for you need to help yourself. And so getting back into a gym, working towards a goal, was really the purpose of trying to make a comeback. It was less about getting on a field and performing. And the lockout only intensified, that not happening. But it ultimately didn't matter, because I had direction then. Very soon after is when I first met with Mark Gerson and started this company. And not soon after that was when I started having these conversations with Eric Spitz and CBS Sports Radio. And so it worked out. And, I don't want to say I'm lucky because you luck comes from that crossroads of being prepared for something and the opportunity presenting itself, and that happened for me.
But it was a propeller mentally.
Oh, of course. It just got me engaged. It's so easy to disengage. We get caught in the cyber world, or you get caught in the ease of not doing anything. But that's no way to live life.
No. The fact that now that there's been so much attention to the League of Denial piece, mm-hmm. or the documentary, I should say,
yep.
did that reaffirm your confidence in your decision to leave early at all?
You know, not really, but it may, I mean, in retrospect, it's some of the things I was thinking about, but not in that context. I mean, for my last year, which was 2006, we played the Cowboys. I got a concussion. I know I did, because I was unconscious. Literally 4 plays later, because Drew Bledsoe threw an interception right before halftime to Sam Madison, and after halftime, Tony Romo started his career that's been now going on for 78 years. I went right back onto the field, and knowing what I know now, there's no way I would have done that or been allowed to do that. But in that moment, I remember saying, I can't keep getting knocked out or knocked around and not have a long-term repercussion. You know, and so it reaffirmed my decision to retire at the time, but looking back at it, I know I made the right decision, not even knowing the context of what concussions and repeated concussions can do for you long-term health-wise.
Do you feel the NFL should be more accountable?
I think everybody needs to be more accountable because the science is too young for us to make definitive proclamations about what concussions do to people. I honestly believe some people handle them differently. You can get one and be fine in a couple of hours. Others, you get one severe or not severe, and it takes you 2 weeks. The brain is too complex for us to blanket state that a concussion has this effect long term.
But the documentary did provide this sort of long, since 94 they've been trying to do this research.
But think about even that. 94 is not that long ago. I mean, if we had data going back to the, you know, the 40s or the 50s, it'd be different. And it's kind of anecdotal right now. It's not really scientific. And while we tend to focus, perceptually at least, and this is media's role to scare, I think, in some regards, we focus on those cases that have come to light, like the Dave Duersons or Junior Seau, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. There are literally thousands of guys who retired and have not a problem at all. So you can't ignore it. I mean, and you wonder, is it a statistical certainty that a percentage, no matter what they do, are going to have these issues or not? You know what I mean?
Right. I mean, and actually, our guest before our episode, a woman named Maggie Burbank, who's a producer with Real Sports, mm-hmm. And that's a program that I think is fairly well respected.
Agreed.
That's done a lot of work on the, you know, following these athletes.
Yep.
Is it scary to you to see some of these ALS patients in this state of dementia?
Some of it is scary. I think that almost every athlete who's ever played a physical sport and had contact is going to show evidence of chronic traumatic encephalopathy, which is this tau that exists on your brain, these dark spots. I think it's a matter of where it is, right? Does it hit your decision-making centers? Does it hit your memory centers? Does it hit, you know, motor function? Those type of questions are not easily understood because you can only diagnose posthumously, which I mean, there's no test for it. Like, I don't know if I'm going to go crazy, right? Nor does anyone, for that matter. But I think as much research as can be put into it is possible, needs to be done. And I think it's an existential problem for the NFL in the long term, because if whatever percentage it is, 2, 5, 20 of former players are dying unnaturally, then the game can't exist. And so the research needs to be done, and it needs to be done in a transparent way.
Do you feel the changes the league has made are tangible?
It's helping, yes, without a doubt. And then anyone who denies that doesn't know what they're talking about, because right now if you get a concussion, you're out, even if it's a slight one. You don't get to come back in. You can't even lie your way out of it anymore, which I think guys tend to do because they don't want, they realize that their job is in jeopardy, right? It's so easy to replace people in this sport, and different than other sports. You're an interchangeable part. Yes, you may have a marginally greater benefit to your team, but someone else can still do your job, And guys know that, so they don't want to be hurt, you know. And so it's a fight to get guys to self-report. And the obvious example is Alex Smith. You know, mm-hmm. He lost his job because he self-reported a concussion to Colin Kaepernick. Yes, he's, you know, now he's sitting on an 8-0 team in Kansas City. And so it all worked out for the best, yeah. But it easily could have not.
And he still wasn't starting for a Super Bowl
team.
You know?
Exactly.
I'm sure that's a scary factor. Before, in our final moments, and I want to get to the topic of race, but just to hit on a news topic. I know on Boomer and Carton, you said you'd reached out to Coughlin and
yep.
See if, you know, you can mend fences. Have you heard it from him at all?
I have. If the relationship happens, it happens. If not, I'm not going to lose sleep over it.
Right.
Tom's a great coach. He didn't treat guys the right way. He changed. And I think to his benefit, and guys view him differently now. But I'm never going to sit idly and say somebody was the way they were if they weren't. And people ask me a question about him, I tell the truth. It is what it is.
Yeah. Who were the football guys you looked up to
In the league? In the league? Coaches? Players? Either? You know what's interesting? I like some of the young coaches in the NFL these days. Sean Payton, I've always been a big fan of. Mike Tomlin. And a lot of it is because of how they talk and nurture. Right? Because so much of football is teaching information. It's you gotta know that when you get into the game, you can trust what you've learned. Right? And how you get guys to learn that is one of two ways. It's you yell and you know you demean and you do it the old school way, or you take an approach where you're empowering them to learn it themselves and take ownership and responsibility. And I think Sean does that. I know he does. I mean, he was my offensive coordinator for a few years with the Giants. And Mike Tomlin, you know, hearing him, even if it's rhetorically, just, you know, imploring guys to do things a certain way, you tend to get motivated. You know, it's positive reinforcement with a kick-ass kind of effect to it. And so those guys I tend to root for because I like the way that they go about teaching the game.
And you talk about a guy that had to get himself off the mat. He was told not to do anything for a year as Peyton.
Yeah, of course. I mean, hell, going back to when Peyton was with the Giants, I mean, people forget that Jim Fossil took the play-calling duties away from him. and then he was kind of in a no-man's land for a couple of years. He was assistant, I don't even really know what he was, with Dallas and the Parcells. Then he became an official coach. And then, obviously, the opportunity came up in New Orleans, and we've seen him rise that one time and lead his team to a Super Bowl, to a city that was devastated by Hurricane Katrina. And then to have the bounty gate happen a couple years afterwards where he gets suspended for the year, and who knows how, if that penalty was overly harsh, because similar programs, I'm sure, existed in most NFL locker room. And to rebound and come right back, have his same influence, not be daunted or not be changed, but be resilient, is something that you gotta respect.
Did you like Fossil?
I did. I did. Only because he taught me how to handle criticism, mostly by example, but also in just having conversations with him. Because I mean, he knew his job was literally on the line every single time that he went to a season. Ernie, of course, he did not hire him. Ernie was our general manager at the time. He was hired by George Young. And they wanted to go a different direction for a lot of years. And he was consistently fighting for his professional life as a head coach. And we had some great success under him.
What was your greatest memory as a Giant?
This is an easy one. It was the week after Wellington Mara passed away in 2005. We played the Washington Redskins, and I had a fantastic day. Rushed for 211 yards, and my last carry was a touchdown. Where I took the ball and I gave it to Wellington's grandson, and then took myself out of the game because I wanted to honor him. He was such a great man. I was close with both he and Bob Tisch, who passed away a few months later. So to honor them on the field in a way that you can't really do any other method, it meant a lot to me.
Do you miss the camaraderie?
Less the camaraderie, more the stage. You know, I think there's different dynamics in every locker room. You know, there's cliques just like there are in high schools. You know, whether it's the guys that are, into hip hop or cars or politics or whatever. I mean, you find your niche. But as I got older, it was hard to find a niche. You know, I spent most of my time talking to Jay Feely, who was our kicker, because we had a common interest in media and the world. So it was less about that. It was more about the immediacy of performing and knowing success and failure in tight moments, right? I think everybody is up for review, or they try to make quarterly goals or whatever it may be. In sports, you know, right? And you're going to either be lauded or criticized right then. And there's something romanticized about that. And that's why we love sports in this country.
Is it tough not to get that immediate feedback after a show?
It is. But, there's also an adrenaline that comes with doing this type of show that's similar to being on a football field. Obviously, it's not as physical. But there's an adrenaline to hitting it just right and getting the feel just right. Especially when you have three hosts, because we're all dynamic personalities, type A in our own way, and so we butt heads, but we also collaborate, and finding that ebb and flow is challenging, but it's the stage, it's doing it on the stage that makes it fulfilling.
And the biggest stage was the Super Bowl. What was it like when you took the field?
You know, I've blocked out a lot of that.
I didn't ask for the end result. I just
no, I'm serious. But yeah, I honestly don't remember a lot of that game. I don't. I remember, the aura around the stage, and realizing that there's a Japanese media crew covering this game. Why? I don't know. They don't play football in Japan, or at least not at a high level in Japan. But it's the world stage, and everyone pays attention because nobody else plays football like we do in America. So the stage was awesome. The celebrity was around it was awesome. The pump and the circumstance was awesome. Really quickly it becomes just a game. Mm-hmm. And it was a game that was forgettable. The Ravens had one of the most dominant defenses in the history of the NFL, and we never got going.
And I know I've kept you here longer than I said, and I apologize for that.
That's all good.
Tell me, Race, I did want to talk to you about the whole, because I know you felt some of the coverage surrounding you was racially driven. And
not necessarily racially driven. I think it's what we get caught in, mm-hmm. right? Things that we think matter that don't. My personal life, just like your personal life or that person across the street's personal life, is really no one's business unless I make it so. We tend to take heroes, whatever form that is, and try to break them. Because I don't know if we want to see them come back or we want to see them tested. At this point it's not important because my family, both my current and my ex, we weathered it. And we're all better for it. But people had an unhealthy obsession with something that was none of their business.
But I want to go more in broadcasting in general. You talked about when people are in the Howard Stern interview back in December, the Michael Strahan comparison. You should have had Strahan's career, whatever.
I could never have Strahan's career. Right. I would never want Strahan's career because he's a different person than I am. People like to simplify things because we are conditioned from a very young age to protect our psyche by denying what's existing in our life and talking about someone else's life, or knocking someone down because it makes you feel better about yourself. Michael Strahan and I are completely different people. I chose a career path that has worked out, has not worked out, but the ups and downs are life, and I don't regret any of them. They come my way, but people want to put things in black and white. They want to say, well, this didn't happen because. Probably didn't happen because of a lot of reasons. This happened because. No, it probably happened for a lot of reasons as well, some of which you're just not privy to. It's oversimplification that bothers me because I'm not a simple person. And life is complex. And if you know that, then get me. If you don't know that, then you don't get me.
But you were happy, as you said in the interview, that an African-American man was in such a prominent role.
Oh, yeah, of course, because it's very rare that there are role models on television that are African-American. Maybe that's just because of testing, viewing habits, whatever it may be. But Michael crosses over perfectly, because that's what you see on television is exactly his personality. But there are very few vehicles where an African American can be exactly his personality, and people accept it, other than Kelly and Michael. And so, it's awesome that he crosses over that way, because I think he'll create opportunities for whoever's next.
Do you feel you can play a role in that growing at all in the broadcast world?
I don't know. You know, we'll see. My broadcast career is always evolving, and just like my life is always evolving, just like my professional life as an entrepreneur is always evolving. It'd be too naive of me to predict where it goes, because I don't know.
What's one thing about you that people would be surprised to learn?
That I'm actually kind of a big homebody.
That doesn't surprise me.
I you know, like, no, because they see me everywhere. They see me out in public, and they see me doing things, whether it's radio or starting a business. But I'd much rather be at home and lay on the couch getting my head rubbed by my wife than going out to a movie premiere or, you know, some sort of event. I lead a simple life. It seems like complex, and I've accomplished and done a lot and lived a lot. But I'm a simple person.
A complex person living a simple life, up the last two.
Oh, exactly.
Right.
That's a good way to put it.
And lastly, taking out any obstacles that, hypothetically talking, mm-hmm. you know, the next 5 years for Tiki Barber, what's some things you want to do?
It's I don't know. Because every day presents something new. And being a businessman, in addition to walking a separate parallel life as a sports broadcaster, at the same time starting family number two, while raising four kids with an ex-wife, there's a lot, right? So it's hard to even think about what's going to happen next year. But I know one thing. I know the things that I learned as an athlete will always push me towards success, always, because failure is not an option for me. If I just find a way to get up and go forward again.
Is that the biggest thing you learned?
Of course.
And in broadcasting and businesses, I would think that's sort of intertwined in a way.
It is. It's a lot. It's a lot of entanglement.
Yeah.
You could say, because what we're doing is creating something that people want. Interactions with athletes, the enthusiasm. The same thing on the radio. We're creating something that people want. Opinions on sports. And so there's a lot of similarities in the things that I'm doing right now. I like that.
This was really nice of you to do, and I appreciate it.
Oh, my
and,
pleasure.
For whatever it's worth. I mean, you don't take a day off, by the way.
No.
I mean, there are no vacation days for Tiki.
Wednesdays, I take the after CBS radio show day off. But really, I work. You know, it goes back to when I was in college. Christmas, Thanksgiving, all those I was playing football. I was training for football, just getting ready. And I take the same mentality now. And it's always been because if I'm not doing it, someone else is. And I want to be the one that does it.
You still live with that.
Yeah, I always will.
Thanks so much to Tiki. He really couldn't have been more generous with his time or more approachable when I asked him to do the interview. And I'm pleased to introduce a new segment to the end of Let's Talk. It's called Final Thoughts, where I'll be weighing in on a topic that's been in the headlines during the week or that I feel is of importance, and this week I think we have one of them. As the story involving Dolphins offensive linemen Jonathan Martin and Richie Incognito continues to develop, many want to use it as a platform to start a national conversation about bullying. I will not use this platform to weigh in on the Dolphins situation. The relationship between Martin and Incognito, along with the dynamics among others on the team, appear to be quite complex, and it would require a lot more time to provide each of the subplots of this story the appropriate nuance. If we are serious, though, about starting a conversation about bullying, that is a topic I will participate in, using strictly facts. According to bullyingstatistics.org, in 2010, 1 in 7 students, grades kindergarten through 12th grade, is either a bully or has been a victim of bullying. The website also says 15% of all students who don't show up for school report it to being out of fear of being bullied. From 4th to 8th grade, the number skyrockets to 90% of students who say they were bullied at some point. If statistics don't resonate with you, or you're wondering what the actual results of bullying can be, just over 2 months ago in Lakeland, Florida, Rebecca Sedwick, just 12 years old, committed suicide on September 9th, jumping off a cement factory tower due to months of bullying by as many as 15 girls. With authorities taking a somewhat unprecedented step of charging two of the girls, one 14, the other 12, with third-degree aggravated stalking, a third-degree felony. And this didn't come out of the blue. The abuse was reported to the school, and Rebecca had transferred schools to get away from the crowd authorities say quote-unquote terrorized her. But the harassment continued through cyberbullying, via text messages, online message boards, and other sites. And when the bullying is done this way, there's just no way for anyone to physically or verbally step in to defend the victim and silence the bully. The victim is forced to fend for his or herself while the cyber world gets to be a witness. Rebecca had also started cutting herself. Police have since said bullying was just one of the contributing factors to Rebecca taking her own life, but it doesn't minimize the impact. It also doesn't take much to find a lot more of these cases around the country. Ironically, on Facebook, a venue where Rebecca was tortured, there is a page, Rebecca Sedwick Against Bullying, with the caption above, "Stop bullying, no one deserves to feel worthless." There are 20,197 likes. It's not even close to a potential solution, but I suppose it is a start. That does it for this episode of Let's Talk. Thanks again to Tiki Barber. We will see you next time. For now, I'm Jacob Wilkins. Take care, everybody.